This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
I hope that a new generation can listen to our own experiences and then make up their own minds. Now, let me go back to 9/11. 9/11 occurred and I was a graduate student in Medina. It's cliched now to say that it was a wake-up call for so many of us. It was definitely a wake-up call for me. And it made me realize that my place was back here, preaching and teaching to my own peoples in the English language, that I needed to come back and give da'wah. There was just so much misinformation about Islam, so much fear, so much antagonism. And so I, you know, wrapped up my master's program. Instead of completing a PhD in Medina, I came back to America and started my PhD here at Yale. And, you know, for the first few years, I was busy teaching with our institute. You know, Basil was one of our earliest students, very active on our forums. We taught all types of classes, aqidah and fiqh and hadith and Sahih Bukhari. But, you know, there was this unspoken rule that we don't talk about jihad and we don't talk about foreign policy and we don't talk about America's involvement in the Middle East. Why? Why did we not do that? Primarily because it was very, very difficult. Our own government, our own countries, our own, you know, the Western world, America in particular, the people were still in complete shock from 9/11. And they were so traumatized that to merely attempt to explain, to merely attempt to contextualize, would have been perceived as a justification. At that point in time, to be brave and point out foreign policy issues, right? You know, if you were Noam Chomsky, if you were, you know, white Caucasian preaching out against American foreign policy, you would be marginalized and just not mainstream. But if you were a brown-skinned cleric, you would be in Guantanamo, frankly, or at least in jail, you know? If you were a brown-skinned Muslim cleric in that time frame where the paranoia and emotionalism was at an all-time high, and, you know, we knew of people, I know people, and Basa knows people, who are totally innocent and are still sitting in jail right now as we speak, you know, for nothing except thought crimes. And for maybe some who are a little bit more than that, but not actual terrorism, you know, maybe speaking or doing things that definitely in the gray area. So all of us felt that it wasn't wise to address these issues, you know, head on. And so we adopted silence. And we taught our classical sciences and Aqidah 101 and Fiqh 101 and Hadith 101. And we just did not really discuss the elephant in the room. And this is 2004, 2005, 2006. This is, you know, Al-Qaeda is growing stronger and stronger. Attacks are taking place, you know, across the world, in Europe as well. One or two here in America are taking place. And we're getting more and more confused. And during this time, confused meaning, how do we confront this? Not confused, like we all know what our group of people from our institute, we're all on the same wavelength, that we were not, definitely not pro-American. We were definitely not American foreign policy. We're definitely criminalizing what our own country is doing from an ethical standpoint and from an Islamic standpoint. But we're also not on the side of these movements that think it is okay to just kill and launch bombs and you know, Times Square. There was an attack in Times Square. Somebody tried to blow up a bomb in Times Square. You know, people doing things in Europe, in France, and whatnot. And we, all of us, did not agree with that methodology, you know, as well. So what we did was we just adopted a code of silence. However, that code of silence had to break eventually. And a number of things happened. You know, first and foremost was the rise of a very influential, very famous cleric who spoke English. You know, pre 9/11, he was probably the most famous preacher and teacher in North America. His cassettes and, you know, there was no YouTube back then. His cassettes and his CDs were basically the rage. Everybody knew them. You know, everybody was listening to them at the time. And even when 9/11 happened, this particular cleric adopted a stance that was basically our own, which was that we're critical of American foreign policy, but we're not going to jump over and say we should start killing the average American citizen. You know, he adopted that for a number of years. And by the way, FYI, for the record, yes, I did interact with this person. He knew me. We were acquaintances. We were never friends, but we were never enemies at that stage. We knew each other. And, you know, he was older than me and senior to me in age. And so, you know, there was that sense of, okay, he's preceding me in the da'wah. I had come back from Medina and he decides to, well, a number of things happened. He went to jail in Yemen. He came out a very different person. And he then basically said, it is obligatory in every single American Muslim to start doing crazy things, blowing up, whatnot. And so, I mean, you have to take a stance. You can't just ignore this. And that was one of the wake-up calls for all of us, that we can't just be quiet anymore. This person is being listened to by our own student base, by American Muslims, Western Muslims, and we can't just ignore that he is calling for an understanding and for violence that we're opposed to. And, you know, that was one wake-up call. Another wake-up call, which again, same time frame, and in fact, related to this individual, and I will mention this person by name because he's in jail now, and that is the infamous underwear bomber, the Omar Farooq Abdulmuttalib or something. I think Omar Farooq Abdulmuttalib, yeah. The underwear bomber, where he tried to, you know, blow up a plane by lighting up a fuse in his underwear that had some bombs and whatnot. And again, this individual had actually attended one of our seminars. You know, he had attended Ilm Summit. I barely knew him. I met him, I said salam, but I didn't really know the person. He wasn't satisfied with us. He left us. He traveled to, you know, Yemen, where this particular individual resided, and he joined his movement. And then he attempted to do what he wanted to do. You know, the government got involved. Our institute's name got dragged in because he had a year before this attended our seminar and then moved on. Alhamdulillah, look, our names have been clear from the beginning. Our institute and our group of people have never been under suspicion of that type of thought because we are crystal clear. And even the research that they did on us, it was very clear. We have nothing to do with that interpretation or that strand of terrorism. So we were clear. That's why we could continue preaching and teaching. And alhamdulillah, by the way, I want to say for the record, none of our core students ever got involved with those terroristic groups. Yes, we had a few people who attended a seminar and then went on to do other things or were in jail now, but these are not people that we consider to be our base of that institute. But Omar Farooq Abdulmuttalib and his case really shook me personally to the core, because I felt that perhaps our silence added to this individual's journey to the dark side or to the wrong side. Perhaps the fact that we didn't address these issues, because I remember clearly that Ilm Summit, I mean, I was in charge of the syllabus, right? You know, we did Sunan at-Tirmidhi, we did, you know, Fitrah, you know, detailed. We did a lot of really, really nice topics. I mean, very interesting. You know, we did history of Andalusia that year, right? But one thing we never did, and this is the height of Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden still alive and he's giving his fatwas, one thing we never did was to talk about these very sensitive, very difficult topics. And I felt that this young man was searching for how to understand these things. He might have traveled to America from his, he was in England. He traveled to America. He spent a week with us. And, you know, he probably liked everything that he saw, but he never heard answers to the questions he had in his mind about politics and about jihad and whatnot. And because that was an empty vacuum, he then goes overseas. He meets, you know, this American cleric, and this American cleric tells him, hey, you know, go blow up a plane. And he did that. And so he's currently sitting in, you know, maximum security jail, life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, a 21-year-old young man, and his entire life is now going to be behind bars, you know, until yani Malakul Maut comes, Allahu musta'an. So I felt that I can't be silent anymore. On top of this, we had a few dozen American Muslims, just literally wrap up and leave and join these movements in Syria, in Iraq, and well, Syria in particular. You know, they just thought that this is their calling. This is what Allah wants them to do. And I got involved once again. Families called me up. I remember once, I'll never forget this, you know, a family called me up that their son had left, and they respected me immensely. And they were worried that his friends and others might follow suit. And I literally flew in to have a meeting with a large group of youth. And they were asking some very difficult questions at the time that, you know, why shouldn't we go and do this? And, you know, a long litany of grievances about our foreign policy, American foreign policy. And by the way, when I say our, it really irritates a large group of people as if I'm justifying. Look, I am an American born and raised here, and I have no other place to go. And when I say our foreign policy, it's not a iqrar, it's not a silent approval. It's a political reality that whether we like it or not, the country that I'm associated with, its foreign policy is causing a lot of violence and grief and damage. And I'm a vocal critic. I've always been a vocal critic, by the way. I've always been a very vocal critic of U.S. foreign policy ever since I started speaking about it. As I said, for 3 years, I was silent. But ever since I'm speaking, it's been a consistent. I've never been supported. And also, by the way, for the record, and I hope everybody's listening to this point here. I have never once spoken about, much less criticized, what people born and raised and living in Muslim lands should do when their lands are invaded. I have never once spoken to and about Syrians or on behalf of Iraqis or what Afghanis should do. That's not my responsibility, nor am I qualified to say what anybody should do living there. And by the way, just for the record, what do you expect a group to do when their land is invaded by foreigners? I mean, it's common sense, but I've never once criticized people on the ground in their lands doing whatever they're doing. My talk and my rhetoric has always been for American or Western Muslims, whether they should leave their lives and join these movements overseas. I have been against this. And I have said that this is not what the Sharia requires, and that you'll end up doing more harm than good. And that many of these movements, if not all of them, they're not really operating from our perspective. Maybe they might be excused from their paradigm, but for us to join their bandwagon, to leave what we're doing, because they might be in halat al-darura, they might be excused for what we might not be excused for. So for us to jump onto their bandwagon, no, I have been a critic of that. So to be very clear here. And by the way, for the record, please, those that are watching, please log on to YouTube right now and look at these lectures I've given. Number one, American foreign policy and the rise of ISIS. Number two, on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, frank remarks on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. This was in a public auditorium in DC, and I spoke to journalists and people on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, to a 2011 basically, and I spoke very frankly about American foreign policy. Number three, when that American cleric was assassinated by our own government, I was the only Muslim, the only national Muslim to publicly condemn our own country. Yes, the wordings I chose, many of the people didn't like that because they wanted it to be harsher. I understand. But my condemnation was published in the New York Times as an op-ed. And in order to get it published in the New York Times, you have to write it in a certain style with a certain language. And this is what a lot of my critics don't understand, is that you want to get the message to the American people that their own government is the ultimate source of these radical movements. And I've said this many times, right? American foreign policy and its bumbling, you know, incomprehensible acts and the travesties of justice that have taken place, Guantanamo, I mean, the gang rape of our sister Abir in Iraq, you know, the IEDs that have been planted. I mean, that's the ultimate source of these movements that have sprung about. It's not coming from the Quran and Sunnah as much as it's coming from a reaction to American foreign policy. But does that justify jumping over to the other side? Anyway, so to conclude my points, I want to hand it over to Basil here. So to link it to our brother Basil, so after Omar Farooq Abdul Muttalib's incident, our institute was being investigated as a potential cause or linkage. Alhamdulillah, as I said, everything was clear because there is no linkage. There never has been to any of these movements, to any of these people. But at the time frame, so the government wanted to interview us and our students. And many of our students felt that this is a betrayal of our Islamic values if we tell the government about this individual and, you know, what he did or what he didn't do. They felt that the wala and bara concept that they had been taught from other, you know, interpretations of Islam, we did not teach that interpretation of wala and bara, but it was around. It was public, this knowledge of wala and bara that is there. And I don't agree with this misunderstanding of wala and bara, but they felt that merely by cooperating with the investigators and answering their questions, that this is a betrayal of the values of Islam. And I remember very clearly, and I was still, you know, at Yale at the time, we had a conference call with all of our senior volunteers and students, and Basit was on that call as well. And the reason why we had that call was that when we told our students to answer and cooperate, Basil, amongst others, but Basil was one of the main people, strongly objected online in our forums. And he used adjectives. I don't remember what this was. It kufr or was it like potentially, whatever it was. But it was like really difficult adjectives where the sentiment was, and I'm sure he didn't mean it, but the sentiment that people understood was that all of us instructors were sellouts, that all of us instructors have lost the plot, and that we've sided with the dark side against, a'udhu billah, the interests of the ummah, okay? Now, I know he didn't use those words, I'm kind of reading it in, but the sentiment that people extracted from it was that, right? And I'll be honest, I was very hurt at Basil's message, and I blamed myself and all of us for not addressing those understandings or misunderstandings from day one. Our tacit silence in the face of a rising interpretation of Islam that we disagreed with, our silence at addressing their shubuhat allowed people like Basil and many others to absorb ideas that I always believed are dangerous, but we never confronted. And Umar Farooq's incident kind of sort of brought this to a forefront. And for a while, you know, Basil and some of his colleagues or friends decided that we were not the institute they wanted to study from. They were kind of sort of like, you know, we weren't trustworthy enough. And it did hurt for a while. But alhamdulillah, a while back, you know, we made recontact and had very frank conversations. And, you know, in the course of our conversations, I realized that these conversations actually need to be made public, because Basil and I aren't just two individuals. We're representative of lots of other people out there. And for us to have this frank conversation and put it online, I hope, inshallah ta'ala, that it causes anybody else who might be having some of these other symptoms or doubts or shubuhat to hear from somebody who has gone through it, and from somebody who was opposed to it from the very beginning, but perhaps maybe wasn't as vocal as needs to be. But anyway, the way that I see this is that these issues are so difficult to talk about for multiple reasons. First and foremost is the level of genuine, bona fide, legitimate anger and rage, like the emotionalism that is natural and Islamic and understood. I mean, every human being, and especially a Muslim, should be angry that our lands are being invaded for no reason, that people are being killed, bombs are being dropped. You know, Guantanamo is still to this day open, still after what, 20, I don't know how many years now, still there are, I don't know how many dozens of prisoners now, they're 70 years old, whatever it is, and still not shut down. You know, gang rapes of American soldiers on Iraqi girls and whatnot. The preacher was killed unethically, constitutionally. I wrote that in the op-ed, but the preacher's teenage son had no crime and they blew him up for no reason. They literally just to smithereens, a'udhu billah. How can you not get angry? Your blood is going to boil at this, right? And so when there's nothing to do and there's all of this anger, and then you have this strand of Islam that says, okay, do something. The feeling comes doing something is better than doing nothing. But that's false, because sometimes doing the wrong thing will exacerbate the situation rather than solve it, right? And that's the point of long-term planning. فَيَا ذُلِّي وَيَا خَجَلِي إِذَا مَا قَالَ لِي رَبِّي أَمَا اسْتَحْيَيْتَ تَعْصِينِي وَلَا تَخْشَى مِنَ الْعَتَبِ وَتُخْفِي الذَّنْبَ عَنْ خَلْقِي وَتَأْبَى فِي الْهَوَى قُرْبِي فَتُبْ مِمَّا جَنَيْتَ عَسَى تَعُودُ إِلَى رِضَى الرَّبِّي تَعُودُ إِلَى رِضَى الرَّبِّي